Everyday injustice. Too many wrongful convictions. Corruption has infected the criminal justice system, leaving too many people helpless, fighting for their lives instead of receiving justice. People suffer. Is that why they say justice is blind?
Today on Everyday Injustice, we have Shannon Boer. He is the author of Judicial Soup, One Man's Wrongful Conviction and What It Means for Criminal Justice Reform. Welcome to the show, Shannon.
Thank you.
So, what is meant by the title Judicial Soup?
In this case that's discussed in the book, there are so many small things that go wrong. And because they're small, you might have many of these in many cases. But when you add them all up, you've changed the mix, the soup. And that's the problem. Everybody's gone out of their driveway and made a wrong turn at one time or another. But you correct that turn. You know, you go down the road and say, oh, no, I was supposed to go here today. In this case, these little mistakes stayed. They were never corrected. The defense attorney tried to correct many of them, but the court didn't want to hear it. And that's why it's a conglomerate of how it comes together.
So tell us about the central case that you cover in the book.
The protagonist is Heath Patrick Thomas. He's an ICE agent. He had been on 18 years. And he has a girlfriend named Carol O'Connor. Carol and Heath and two other couples are out to dinner. They're in a historic area of Georgetown in Washington, D.C. After they leave the dinner, they stop at another place for a nightcap just to continue the conversations. They're there for about an hour and a half, and the service is pretty bad. Two drinks are made with the wrong alcohol. Two drinks are spilled, and one drink has served with a bug in it. And this is over an hour and a half period. So Carol tells Heath to get the tabs to pay him because it's getting late and some people have an early flight the next morning. He goes to the bar to pay the tab and he gives him his name and the name of one other couple, but he doesn't know the other people. And they keep telling him, keep putting him off, so to speak. He finally sees a individual he believes is the manager. He's in the wait area at the bar, and he goes up and asks him if he's the manager, and he says yes. And then he asks him if he speaks Spanish, and he says yes, because Heath speaks Spanish, and the man looked like he spoke Spanish to Heath. So Heath proceeds to tell him in Spanish how poor service, and then explains that he's having trouble paying his bill. The manager responds, saying, if you don't like it, we'll call the cops. Something to that extent. And at this time, Heath sort of blows up and says, I am a cop, effing cop. So he says he immediately calms down and goes back to the bar. And that's when he says he feels a hit. The hit is the bouncer grabbing his arms around him, picking him up and carrying him out of the building. To do so, he goes through 15 or 20 feet in the bar area, into a door, to an antrum area, down a couple steps, to the outside door, down a couple more steps, and all the way to the curb. It's about 40 to 45 feet altogether. While he's being carried out, he realizes that a gun he has in his waistband is coming out. So as soon as he's released, he reaches for the weapon to secure it. The bouncer never really leaves him, and he reaches for the gun too, and a fight ensues over the weapon. Heath insists he was only trying to reset the gun, and the bouncer said he tried to point it at him. The police are called and immediately show up within less than 2 minutes. Heath drops the gun. They hear the bouncer's story, and they hear another story, an individual named Pulibar. And he backs up the bouncer's story, which is he set Heath down. He backed up 3 feet, and then Heath turned with gun in hand. And only his quick action saved the day. Heath's version is believable, whereas the bouncer's version is not. I taught action-reaction models in law enforcement, and the way the bouncer described it, that's something you would see in a movie, but it's not reality. If you lined up 100 people and they were 3 feet behind them, and you said, if they turn with a gun in hand, I want you to grab it, well, they couldn't do it. when you talk about action reaction models in kinesiology, you have the stimulus and you have the reaction time, and then you have the reaction itself. And if two people are in a boxing ring and they expect to get hit, you'll see them block a punch or parry a punch. If the same two people are walking down the street and one sucker punches the other, it's going to land. Well, in this case, the reaction time for the bouncer would have to be beyond his physical capability, human capability. So Heath's story is believable. And what happened then at the investigation, the initial investigation by the police, they talked to bar employees, the bouncer, the manager, and they didn't talk to anybody in Heath's party. Carol, Heath's girlfriend, approached them and said, "Are you going to talk to us? We were with him." And the officer said, "Sure." And he gets her name. And then he says, "Did you see the gun come out?" She says, "No." So the officer turns around and walks away. Basically, the police confirmed what they believe happened by the bouncer story and the manager story and just ignored everything else. There was probably 100 people there that night. And they didn't talk to any other witnesses other than the ones they wanted to. And that's the basic story. When I was hired by Mr. Hannon as his expert witness, I really believed the case would be dismissed before it went to trial. If you read the transcripts, the grand jury transcripts, you can see where there's really not a case there, my perspective. But anyhow, they went ahead with the trial. So then I thought, well, it'll be a couple of days. The trial ended up being 8 days long. It was very extensive. And I couldn't believe the mistakes I was seeing. In the middle of the trial, I said to Heath, "You may have to appeal this," because it just kept coming and just kept coming. It was like being in a nightmare. And as I say, there were four decades in law enforcement, testifying in court hundreds of times, I never saw anything like this case. Even the judge limited what I could testify to as his expert. At one point in the trial, I was supposed to testify, and I was called to the stand, and they had a bench conference, and I was asked to step down and step out in the hallway. Well, there's several pages of transcript saying why I should not testify at that time. One being that Heath had not testified. Well, Heath was the charged party. He doesn't have to testify. He doesn't have to prove his innocence. The state has to prove his guilt. But the judge was not going to let me testify until Heath testified. Now, it never came to that, but I had to think, well, if Heath doesn't testify, does that mean I can't testify? It was strange. Even the appellate court said that I should have testified. But then they also added that if I had testified, it wouldn't have changed the outcome. So it's just strange.
So from your perspective, what went wrong in this case?
I can't say exactly what went wrong, but I could say where it started with the bar manager. The bar manager, I believe, has a lot of people thrown out. This bar had a history of that with ABRA, that's the DC Alcohol Board. And apparently none of the people ever thrown out were a police officer or had any sense or whatever, or any contacts, you might say. In this case, I think it all went wrong when they found out he was a police officer, even though he had said he's a police officer. It is strange how this all came together, like I say. But then the more I delved into it and the more I looked at other cases, I realized that his case is probably not unique. Having been in a profession for over four decades and then learning this was a surprise to me. I always knew there were problems within the criminal justice system. I believed a lot of them were minor. I knew that some very known cases, well-known cases of people being in jail for years had occurred, but I had no idea the extent of it until I started doing the research to write this book about this case.
You know, it's kind of interesting because on the one hand, you spent, as I understand it, 27 years as a police officer in Maryland, and yet you seem unaware of these problems. How can you square those two things?
Look, I have to square it myself. I understand what you're saying. I arrested people for everything, even bank robbery and murder. I had testified in court hundreds of times, but most of these cases were my cases. They weren't other people cases. You know, I don't see that. And I can tell you that I always knew that there were a few police officers out there that had bias and prejudice and stuff like that. And I counseled trainees about that. But I never saw the extent of one case like this. I never experienced 8 days of trial for a minor case. I don't think I ever had an 8 day trial in my career. You know, several days maybe for some, but nothing like this. I mean, I had arrested well over 1,000 people for different crimes in my career. And I just never experienced anything like that. And it's strange in a way, the timing, fortuitous, you might say, that after this, when I started writing the book, you hear about all these other cases. George Floyd obviously being a very large impact. And I had written about police reforms earlier, besides the book. I write a monthly column, and I had written about several instances like that. But I never knew the breadth of it, and I still don't. We don't know how many innocent people are still in jail, but there's been a proliferation of innocent programs around the country. And it's amazing the work that they're doing.
Yeah, and one of the problems is that, you know, let's say somebody is charged with a crime, they plead to a crime, it's a minor crime, so they get probation. And they take the plea because, you know, they don't want to take a chance that they're going to have to do time. So nobody's ever going to evaluate the case. It's a probation case. And yet that person may not have committed that crime. And so it's almost an unknowable problem.
I was talking to an attorney that I was doing some work for, and he was asking me about this book. This was a couple years ago. And I told him that I had looked up cases. I wanted to put them in the documents itself, in the chapters themselves. And later I changed it to where I put them at the end of each chapter that had similar problems to Heath. So people could understand that his is not unique. It's not strange. And I told him I was looking for these cases. And he said, "You want some more?" And he's a defense attorney, but he's a former U.S. prosecutor. And he didn't say he had all these cases, but him and another attorney had started a small construction company for people like you're talking about, because they're guilty of a minor offense. They didn't want to take off work, even if they didn't do the offense. So they pled guilty just to get out of it. And later, when they go to get a job, they can't because they have this on their record. And that's a large premise of the book. That if you can find hundreds, if not thousands, of cases of people sentenced to life or to death row, how many cases like Heath's exist? And yet, as a democracy, the trust in law enforcement is one of the centers, like the trust in voting. I mean, because law enforcement represents the government at every level. And obviously, there's a lot of lack of trust there, and for good reason.
From your perspective, you know, if you had to point a finger, I mean, is it a systemic problem? Is it the police? Is it the prosecutors? Is it the judges? Is it the jurors that kind of at times reverse, you know, the burden of proof? I mean, I could see all sorts of different angles to that.
I think it does involve all of them. What I suggested in the book, with all these cases that we have that are documented, a lot of books been written about the subject and so forth. A research project would involve doing interviews of the officers, the prosecutors, the police officers, to find out what went wrong, and you would have a better definition of the problem. In the meantime, you have people in authority, and I'll use prosecutors as an example, who can withhold evidence, exculpatory evidence, evidence that would prove somebody's innocence or lessen their part in the crime. And withholding that evidence has caused people to be in jail for 30, 40 years when they're innocent. And yet there's no responsibility for that prosecutor. They have the authority, but they don't have any consequence with it. In one case that's in the book, a man is in jail for 25 years for killing his wife, allegedly. He didn't kill his wife, but the prosecutor withheld exculpatory evidence. When that comes to light many years later, he's released. And the state actually took action against the prosecutor, who was later promoted to a judge. Now, the man spent 25 years in jail. The judge pled guilty in court, retired, and was given a 10-day jail sentence. There's no balance there like that. And in many of these cases that I cite in the book, I ask some serious questions. Like this case, what happened to the other cases this judge prosecuted, that he judged, and also the police sergeant that was with him that knew he held withheld evidence? In other words, it's not a one-off. It's a pattern of behavior with some people. And I do believe that the majority of prosecutors, like the majority of police and the majority of attorneys, are good people and they want to do right. But with so many attorneys, I mean, there's 900,000 police officers in the country, so you know some just aren't going to be up to the task. But there's more attorneys than that. So I don't, with no responsibility for your actions, it's hard to hold people accountable.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you mentioned the Michael Morden case and Ken Anderson, who was the former prosecutor.
Yes.
I mean, that's actually the example of the rare instance where the prosecutor is held accountable, granted slap on the wrist compared to the 25 years that Morden spent in prison.
Yes.
You know, one of the things that I often see is, you know, watching court cases a lot. You can see lots of mistakes that are happening in real time, and you can kind of catch them. But, you know, as you were watching this, were there like moments in time where you're like, we here's a point where somebody should have been able to intervene and stop this thing?
There were several. I'll give you several examples. Everybody that testified for the prosecution said that the bouncer, when he picked Heath up, picked him up around the shoulders, not around the waist. Now, the bouncer is like 6'2", 230 pounds. And Heath's like 5'8", 190 pounds at the time. And he was in really good shape. So picking somebody up around the shoulders is next to impossible. It's just, and you, I can't help but think that they were coached, because Heath had said to the police, "I think he felt my gun." In other words, with his arms around it. So Hannon, the defense attorney, and I give him a solid B for his defense. He was pretty good in my mind. He has the bouncer pick himself up, the attorney. And when he picks him up, he's got his arms pinned around his waist, and he said his thumbs were in my belly button. And everybody just ignored that in the court. In other words, they're not, and Hannon explicitly said that. And another case, the officer that actually arrested Heath is testifying. And the attorney, Mr. Hannon, again, asking, "Why did you handcuff Heath and not the bouncer?" And that caused some consternation in the court back and forth. The judge was a little miffed at it. So the judge finally says to the police officer, "You can say why you locked him up and not he and not the bouncer." So the officer says, very simple and plain, "I knew the bouncer. He was the one in the red shirt. And I was taking notes in the court, and I just stopped in stunned behavior and wondered if somebody was going to follow up. If you knew both of them, would you not lock either one up?" In other words, it was it's predetermined that the person is arrested, they're going to look for stuff to find them guilty. And in this case, there was no investigation. There was just a confirmation of what the bar manager said happened and the bouncer. That's one of those strange things. A couple more happened in court like that. There was a film of the arrest, not of the arrest, of the interview of Heath Patrick Thomas made by the charging officer. And in the film, Heath seems calm and normal, and the officer actually testified that he didn't think Heath was drunk at all. But the prosecuting attorneys, both of them, fought the entrance of this film into evidence. And this went on for a while. Why he shouldn't, because he makes statements about the crime, and no, he didn't, on and on and on. The judge finally gets frustrated enough to say, let me watch the film, and he watches the whole film. Well, there's nothing that the prosecution said was in the film about his protestation of innocence, you know, that sort of thing. And yet the judge didn't say anything to these prosecuting attorneys. And evidence was limited. My testimony was limited by the judge. We made a film of what we believe happened, and that wasn't allowed in. I mean, it's almost like the judge had a predetermination. And I wondered sometimes if it wasn't because the trial took so long. The initial estimates were 3 days, and the trial ended up being 8 days in length.
I've seen that a lot where, you know, the judge is trying to conduct the trial, and they make mistakes, it seems, when they start to get impatient with things. They allow stuff in that they shouldn't allow in. They exclude stuff that they shouldn't exclude because they're thinking, oh, okay, we don't want to keep the jury longer than we told them it was going to be. We don't, you know, we have limited staff space. And so that time pressure, I think, is an underrated part of mistakes that get made.
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. It is strange how the trial judge in this case limited things, like I say, because I think it was too long. But at the same time, it's almost like he favored the prosecution. The attorney, Michael Hannon, like I say, I think he did a good job. The judge, it's like he looked at him almost as if the enemy. He chastised him several times for different things, that he wouldn't say anything to the prosecution witnesses. At one time, Mr. Hannon wanted to enter statements given to him by the prosecutor's office that Heath made to different parties on the night of arrest. And the judge wouldn't let any of that in. And yet, if you're arrested and you say, I'm sorry, I shot him, they would let that in. You know. But if you say I'm innocent, he didn't let that in. And those statements would contradict some testimony at the trial. Now, I don't know if the judge would have picked up on that or not, but he should have. You have this witness who is a 20, 22-year-old Marine. He's not in uniform. And he basically testifies to what the bouncer testifies to. And he says he witnessed this, and although he didn't witness it with the manager, he says he witnessed with the bartender. But his description of the person he's talking to fits the manager and not the bartender. So after Heath says, I am a effing cop, and goes back to the bar, and the bouncer picks him up, this 22-year-old Marine follows him outside, he says. He said he's making his way, so I might as well follow him. And he's a principal witness that confirms what the bouncer said. The problem is when he's outside in the grand jury and at the trial, they ask if anybody else is there. He said, yeah, there's a woman there in front of me. Well, who's the woman? Well, that's Carol. Well, how did she get out? I don't know. Well, the bouncer picked Heath up, and they're walking out. Behind the bouncer is the bar manager because he has to open the inside door. behind the manager is Carol, because she's following them. So this witness was not in line. He came out late, and I really believe he heard the bouncer's story and then just stuck to it. And that should have been challenged in court. When he was first found guilty by the judge, before any trial sentences or any hearings on that, Mr. Hannon filed papers to either change it to a not guilty verdict or have a new trial. And he listed so many items in there that were problematic. And I think listing those things probably offended the judge. When you're going the wrong way down the road and you think you're going the right way, the last thing you want to do is turn around and check for directions. It would embarrass the judge, I think.
Yeah, although I would say, having watched trials for 15 to 20 years, I can't think of a single case except for one where the judge, even considered throwing out the jury verdict. And the only case where I saw it happen, the state law actually changed, so the judge had no choice. In between the jury verdict and the sentencing, this state law actually changed. But other than that, I haven't seen it happen. So I'm wondering, and obviously you spent a lot of time on this case. It was obviously frustrating for you not to be able to testify for all that work that you did. But what was kind of your goal in writing this book? Why did you decide to write the book on this case?
I'm hoping, let me start by saying that the innocent people in jail are not the problem. They're a symptom of the problem. I don't care how many innocent programs you have, if you keep emptying out the jails of the innocent people, they're still coming in the other end. And the way to prevent that, at least some of it, is to hold the people responsible for their authority. And this authority goes on for many, many, many things, not just exculpatory evidence. You have evidence in some of the cases that I include in the book that comes forward, and then the prosecuting attorney leaves the person in jail because they're going to try him again. And then 2 years later, they decide not to try him. So they've been in jail for 2 years waiting for the prosecutor. And sometimes the evidence is longer than that. In one case, a man was in jail for 30 years, and the state innocent program wanted to look at the evidence. Well, they didn't find the rape kit that they thought, but they found 43 fingerprints. They never compared the fingerprints. A couple years later, his attorney asked, what evidence did they find? The fingerprints. He finds the fingerprints, has them compared, and he's not there. From the time the fingerprints were found, it was another 14 years before he's released. And that's just unconscionable. I mean, you keep an innocent person in jail because you think you might try him again, and you don't have any evidence to try him. And there needs to be some accountability there, some response. You have to be responsible for your authority. And I think that can be done at the state level. I think it can also be done at state bar levels, the bar associations. And like I say, if you looked at these cases and you examined them, you might find some, I know you would find a lot of similarities. I believe you would. And I think that's important, because you want to improve the system. We are human. We make mistakes. But the mistakes in this case, to me, so many of them are intentional.
So from your perspective, as we wrap up here, what types of reforms are you looking at for the system at this point?
I would like to see reforms for everything. In other words, across the board. And the way to do that is for the federal government, the Justice Department, to do some research into this to find out. You have hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent people that have been exonerated. And that's not counting, like you say, all the minor incidents. And that's just ridiculous. It's it doesn't put faith. It takes faith away from your government, and you're ruining these people's lives. And if you want faith in the government, they have to have faith in the justice system. You can reform police all you want, and it will get better. But until you look at the whole system, how it works, you're only, it's like having one flat tire and working on that and not paying attention to the other three. You need to look at the whole system. And I'm hoping this book starts a conversation in that direction. Because I believe there's enough good people out there that want to see it improved.
It feels like there should be, but I've been doing this for a long time and there seems to be a lot of resistance.
I was being interviewed at a pitch session where I was pitching the book. And I said something to the gentleman about supporting Blue Lives Matter and at the same time supporting Black Lives Matter. And he kind of looked at me with a puzzled look. And I said, if you support justice for everyone, then you should support the police, the honest police. And if you support justice for everyone, you should support Black Lives Matter. I don't support people that loot and burn, and I don't support police that plant evidence or abuse their power. It surprised me that he felt that I had to make a choice. Or at least that's the impression he gave. I don't think he had looked at it that way before, but I can't say for sure. And I think that's the education that needs to be done. If you look at, and I'll just mention this one thing on police. If you look at George Floyd, that was horrific. But it should never have happened. And the reason I say it should never have happened is if I'm to believe that he had 17 valid complaints for use of force, then why was he a training officer? You know, that's just wrong to begin with. And you see a lot of that. You see the officer, I've seen a lot of examples where the officers should have been punished, charged, or dismissed many years before, and they were not. And they just hang around and hang around, and eventually a disaster of that kind of proportion happens.
What was the most surprising thing you learned while researching for this book?
Probably the length of time that people spend in jail after the evidence against them shows they didn't do it. One man, 64 years old, he was arrested when he was 20, spent 30 years in jail before they started looking at the fingerprints. And then it was 14 years later. Well, if you go to jail when you're 20 and now you're 64 years old, that's just horrific. Some other things that I found was a case in Louisiana where a man is found innocent. And in the book, I give the exact number. I don't remember how many people it has, but like 320 people have been exonerated from their crimes and released from death row in the country since 1973, whatever the number is. And I think he was the eighth person in that state. You know, that's the numbers speak for themselves sometimes. And in that particular case, I when I'm talking about it in the book, I say, if we investigate aircraft accidents, if we investigate train accidents, and we investigate industrial accidents, and we do a white paper because we don't want these accidents to occur, what's more important than our justice system investigating that to find out why these events occur? You know, I mean, that's, it seems common sense to me, but today, in today's society, I'm lost in many ways. The Twilight Zone has come back and it's real.
Well, we'll leave it on that note. Thank you, Shannon, for joining us today. We've been talking with Shannon Boer. His book, Judicial Suit, One Man's Wrongful Conviction and What It Means for the Criminal Justice System, Very interesting case, very interesting discussion. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it very much.
This has been Everyday Injustice. Join us again next week for more tales from the injustice system.
Thank you to George Powell and Norman Mouse Quake Barrett for the use of our opening, Everyday Injustice. You can see more of George's music at www.justiceforgeorgepowell.com.